Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
Before we start this week, I want to tell you about New York Times Audio, a new iOS app for New York Times News subscribers. New York Times Audio collects all of the shows you've grown to love. The Daily, this very podcast, which I know you're a fan of, but also a bunch of new shows we've made just for the app. There's The Headlines, our latest morning show, this one hosted by Annie Coryall, that gets you caught up on stories in 10 minutes or less. You're busy, you want to know what's going on in the world, we got you. Another new offering is something we're calling Shorts, which is a short-form series, 5 minutes, 7 minutes, that gives you inspiration for what to cook, watch, read, and more. Every morning, there will be a new daily playlist with our most exciting highlights. This new app will have narrated articles from The Times, as well as other outlets that publish some of the best long-form magazine writing around. And finally, you'll have one-stop access to episodes from The Athletic, Serial Productions, and one of the godfathers of modern podcasting, This American Life. New York Times Audio. Download it now at nytimes.com/audio app. I'm Gilbert Cruz, and this is the Book Review Podcast, your audio guide to book recommendations, news, and interviews. On this week's show, we'll be talking to Times book critic Dwight Garner about his review of the book Death of an Author, a murder mystery written mostly by artificial intelligence. But first, we'll be discussing the latest in our series, The Essentials, a monthly piece in which we wade through the deep pools of authors' bibliographies and recommend which titles you should read. So far in 2023, we have done Colette, Patricia Highsmith, and Gabriel Garcia Marquez. And this month, we are publishing one focused on Neil Gaiman, written by Jude Beersdorfer, an editor here at The Book Review. Let's turn to that conversation. Jude.
Gilbert.
You're here.
I am, live in the studio.
You're on mic. You're always in our hearts, but you're on mic this week.
Oh, Gilbert, you're making me blush.
So for those listeners who somehow have managed to avoid the work of Neil Gaiman, an author who's done so much, can you start by telling us who he is? What kind of books does he write?
Okay, Neil Gaiman, English author. He started out, I believe, as a music journalist, and I first came to him reading one of his nonfiction works. I think his first book was about Duran Duran. He wrote a biography of Douglas Adams, which is how I got into him because I was very much into The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. But he got heavily into writing comics in the late 80s, early 90s, and did a lot of English comics and not mainstream comics here. But, you know, he pop up occasionally. I think he's done a Batman before. But his big claim to fame was writing The Sandman, which was a 75-issue series, the original run of it, that ran from about 1989 to 1996. So he started off as a big comics guy. People knew him from that. And then he gradually morphed over into adult novels, children's novels, picture books. He's written speeches. He's done screenplays. He's very prolific. And as part of The Essentials, the hardest part was figuring out just which part of his canon to really focus on to get to The Essential, because there's so much good stuff in there.
And which part did you focus on?
I focused on the adult novels, really. I threw in a few mentions of some of the children's books that he did because they are very good. Coraline, which I think people have seen the film of. And then the Graveyard Book, which I believe is on the New York Times bestseller list for more than a year. So for the younger readers, those are great. But I've wanted to focus on, well, this is the book review. We're probably skewing a little bit older here for most of our readership. So let's look at his novels that he wrote for an adult audience, and also maybe a little bit dipping into The Sandman because it was such a landmark series in its time.
All right. Well, I figure we should jump right into it. Let's make some recommendations. I'm going to use your categories from your piece. For those who haven't had the chance to experience one of our Essentials articles yet, we try to break down an author's oeuvre, which is a word I'm going to say every single time we do an audio segment on The Essentials. We try to break them down into sort of categories that fit the type of reader, the type of mood that you might be in at any particular point. So let's start with the obvious. What should I read? What should our listeners read if they're totally new to the work of Neil Gaiman?
I would go with American Gods, as I did in the piece. And it was written in 2001, and it was sort of at the time, if you go in the Wayback Machine a little bit, where technology was really on the rise, and Gaiman was looking around at the world. I think he'd only moved to the States like 6 years before, so he was basically a new immigrant, but he was asking himself the question, what would happen if the people who have come here and brought their old gods, what if those old gods begin to die out because the younger generations don't care about them? And so that was a setup for the book. And some of the new gods are like gods of media and technology. And at the time, this was technology, because we had not really become saturated in it yet. And he worked in some Norse mythology. I'm not going to spoil anything here, but he basically did this sort of road trip novel with this ex-con named Shadow Moon. And he meets this employer, a guy who said, oh, you know, you would be my driver, basically. And they go on this adventure across the country. And it's basically Gaiman's commentary, I think, on what the U.S. was like at the time and what does happen to those old gods when people don't believe in them anymore. And as with many of Gaiman's works, this one has also been adapted for film and TV. This was a TV series, I think, on Stars for a few seasons.
Mm-hmm.
Because he writes so vividly, I think his works are very adaptable for other mediums.
But this isn't the only book he's written in which he dips into mythology, right?
Yeah, no, he's very much into mythology. If you read any interview with him, he talks about how he basically grew up in a library just reading all the books, and he got very much into English mythology and just mythology around the world. So he's done one that was considered a slight spinoff of American Gods called Anansi Boys, which takes these Caribbean folk tales and builds upon them into a story. And then in 2017, he did a book on Norse mythology. So you get all your big gods there, your Thor, your Odin, the ones you've seen in the Marvel comics. This is actually where they came from. And he goes back and looks at that just because he is so deep into the mythology tales.
What was the first Neil Gaiman book that you read?
After the Douglas Adams nonfiction one, which was very good, I actually came upon Good Omens first, which is his first novel, but he co-wrote it with Terry Pratchett, who English mythology fans will know from his Discworld series. You know, it's a fantasy series that's based in this Discworld. And so they co-wrote it, and they argue about who did more on it. And Pratchett has since died. But I came upon this book. It was one of those used books, you know, back in the days when you can get the books in the cart at the Strand or whatever, because I was broke and just picked it up. And it's very funny. If you like any of the Douglas Adams' Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, that type of humor, or the Monty Python, just the classic high-low comedy clashing. It's a great book. It's basically Monty Python does the Omen, to cast a very wide description of it. But it was fun, and you could just tell these two guys were probably, as they were writing back and forth, just trying to wind each other up and to see who could be the most outrageous, because it is quite funny. And that, again, is an Amazon series. Season 2 is coming out at the end of July.
So Douglas Adams, Terry Pratchett, Monty Python, are you an Anglophile?
A little bit. I mean, I grew up in rural Indiana, where they would show Monty Python like late night on Friday on the PBS station, because I guess it was considered mature or something. But then all the movie, The Holy Grail and The Life of Brian and all of that. So I perhaps was attracted to that type of humor. Not so much into everything English. Definitely the humor and the literature and just the way that they kind of will use their Oxford, Cambridge background and then just do like completely silly stuff with it.
Let's go to another category. I think a lot of people, if they do know Neil Gaiman but haven't dipped into his work, know him for things that can be categorized as fantastical, slightly creepy, maybe very creepy. Let's say you don't like scary things, however. You want something that has an amazing story but is not going to give you the willies. What would fall into that category?
I would have to say Stardust, which to me, it brings to mind The Princess Bride, that kind of light fairy tale stuff, but it's got a little bit of an edge to it. And he wrote that one, I think, with Charles Vess. It was originally an illustrated thing. And then, as with a lot of Gaiman's works, they get re-edited and he does his preferred author's test, or he'll do a version with an illustrator. Stardust was really fun, and it went back to the Victorian era of fantasy, before we really got into the Tolkien and the Lewis and the big epic adventures and orcs and things, where it was gentler. You know, in the land of fairy, this happened. And that's very much what this book was about. It's a story of a young man who is trying to impress a girl. And so he promises to go get a fallen star. And then he has to go over the wall into this other realm to find it. And that's when the adventure starts.
This seems like it would be a good bridge maybe between something like Coraline or any of his other children's works, and maybe something more adult.
And even with Coraline and the Graveyard Book, I think those had a huge adult audience too, even though they were marketed to kids. And he said in one interview that he was worried that Coraline was going to be too scary. And so he was testing it out on his kids, and they were like, what comes next? So I think kids can take horror. You know, people say, oh, you know, it's too scary for them. But kids are really realistic about stuff, and they will just go with it. And if the story is good, the kids are there.
Can we take a detour into Coraline? Because even though your Essentials is about Gaiman's books for adults, I feel like Coraline has a very strong, partially because of the wonderful stop-motion animation film that was made from it, has a strong pull on the culture these days. Are you a fan of Coraline?
Oh, yeah. Well, I liked it just because it was an adventure book that actually had a female protagonist. I know they're a little more common these days, but, you know, 10 or 20 years ago, it was still a lot of boy adventures or adventures where the girls didn't get to do really exciting things. And Coraline come along, and you know, she's in this house, and then there's this house that's just like hers on the other side, and the other mother has these black button eyes, and it's very subtle creepiness, but it's really compelling and it sticks with you. But the movie was great. The animated film that they made from it. And I think it's been a stage production as well because the story is so strong and adaptable.
Let's say I don't have that much time, but I want to give this guy a try. What should I look for?
All right. So if you want a really concentrated dose of Neil Gaiman, I would go with The Ocean at the End of the Lane, which is a very slim book. You can probably read it if you have a free afternoon in one sitting. And it's a memory story about a guy who goes back to the area in rural England where he grew up in, and he starts to have these memories of what happened back then, and there was this great evil in the land, and he's trying to reconstruct it, and it takes him back to where he was all those years ago. I think partially because it is so short a book, it's very intense, and you just keep reading the story, and it gets creepier and creepier, and it's got a lot of things that, you know, a little unsettling. There's a bit with invasive worms in there.
Yeah.
And it's about this guy when he was young and his best friend who was a farm girl next door. It's a good short flight book.
Are you speaking from experience?
Perhaps, yeah. I have a traveling copy of Good Omens that I take with me just because usually the airport stresses me out and this book makes me laugh. But if I had to take another one, I'd probably take Ocean at the End of the Lane.
Let's talk about possibly his most famous work. It's not one that you recommend starting with because it's pretty time intensive, but I will say the first time that I became familiar with the name Neil Gaiman was through his comic books, was through The Sandman.
Yeah, The Sandman. And I remember when those came out, I used to go to the comic book store a lot, and that would be one of those ones where you'd see the individual issues come out, and they'd always have these great Dave McKean covers, and they would draw you in, but it would be one of those ones that if you missed a month, you would be freaked out, you'd be missing a chapter. And eventually, I said, I'm just going to wait for the trade combined versions of these, because to me, this is like what we used to do before we had Netflix to binge. You just wait for the trade volume, and then you could read, you know, 8 or 10 issues all right in a row and totally get the concentrated dose of that story. So I remember him from back then. And the 80s were so great for comics anyway. If you look at the Frank Miller era and like The Watchmen that came out, the Alan Moore and Christy Marks doing Sisterhood of Steel. And then Neil kind of brought up the end of that era in 89 with The Sandman. And I think that continued into about 96 of the original run of the stories. And he's done a few little spinoffs here and there.
Tell us briefly, because it's a pretty long story, what is The Sandman about?
The Sandman is his version of this old DC character, which used to be, I think in the 40s, it was this dude running around in a suit with a gas mask, and he would put people to sleep and make them have dreams. And Gaiman, I think, drew upon his background and his interest in mythology and folklore and turned this into a godlike being. And he was one of several siblings called the Endless. There's also Death, Despair, Destruction, Delirium, you know, they all start with D. But the Sandman was Dream. That was his name in this family. He's also called Morpheus, and he ruled the land of dreams and people's hopes and fears and all of that. And in the first arc of the series, which was also mirrored in the Netflix adaptation from last year, he loses his powers and has to fight his way back to regain his realm. And so that sort of sets up his origin story there, because you learn about him just from what he's lost. And then you see him kind of, you know, get his stuff back together, and you meet some of his siblings. And if you ever walked around in the East Village in the 90s, you probably saw a lot of girls dressed like Death, because that was a sister. She was a goth girl with the Doc Martens and the Ankh necklace and the black pants. And she was his big sister and would always kind of like knock him around like a little brother, but they were best friends. And even though he was morose and this kind of very ethereal guy, she could always, you know, get to him.
You just mentioned three giant names in comic books in the 80s. Alan Moore, Frank Miller, Neil Gaiman, he has lasted. He persists. Is it because he's really expanded into all these other genres, into all these other types of books?
I think that's part of it. And he said himself that he didn't want to be pigeonholed as the guy that does this one kind of book. And so he did comics for a while, and then he got into sort of writing the novels. And then because he's bounced around within just fiction, like Stardust is a very light thing. Neverwhere, which is another one of his books, is sort of an urban fantasy. He's never really sat still and just been the guy who just cranks out this one type of thing, you know, like you see in like some of the action and thriller genres. Because I think he's naturally very curious and interested in seeing how other stuff, you know, how he can work with that, you know, given his own background. I think he constantly reinvents himself too, because I mentioned he's always doing his own author's text versions where he's gone back and fixed stuff that's bothered him. It's basically cleaning out the text and doing stuff that like the editors made him cut back when he had less power and could do it. And then he's also, because he's heavily involved in the adaptations of his books, you see Sandman, this has been, you know, 30 years or more since some of these came out, and times and attitudes have changed. And so some of the things that he was writing about, which was actually really progressive for like the early 90s, maybe it's not so much anymore. Particularly, I found like with queer characters and some of those storylines, it was great to get representation back then, but maybe that stuff hasn't aged as well. And so you see him, because he's so involved with the TV adaptations, actually going in and say, well, let's have more representation here. Let's do this here. And he's really modernizing a lot of the work for this new format when he's doing it on TV.
It is crazy to hear you use the word modernizing for something that's only 30 years old.
Culture moves fast, man. You got to keep up with it.
It does. So, Jude, you've gone through several recommendations. You know, they're very specific in their own ways. But generally, who is Neil Gaiman for?
I think it's for people who, A, feel like mythology or feel like psychological horror. Because a lot of his horror-themed stories are based on, like, deep innate fears. And if you want to, like, have some of that or face some of that in yourself, he's great for that because he draws on so many areas to really freak you out. He's got a lovely comedic touch too, Good Omens case in point. If you're into fantasy and horror and stuff that draws on a lot of old myth and legend and just has a really nice background from various cultures, he's a good one to kind of dip into.
I'd like to ask you for a recommendation of one book that is not Neil Gaiman related. What are you reading now?
I'm actually reading a book that was recommended by Greg Coles in the Read Like the Wind newsletter, The Hyphenated Family, about the German family immigrating to Brooklyn in the 1880s. My German family was over here before then, but I was like, oh, I can see some of these similarities. My Germans weren't quite as dour as these ones in Brooklyn, but I see some similarities there. And then I also just got Claire Dederer's Monsters, which I have not started yet, but it's on the top of the reading queue.
Well, like all of us here at The Book Review, you're constantly reading. You've read a lot of Neil Gaiman, and I thank you for coming on to talk about him.
Thank you for having me, Gilbert.
We'll be right back.
Tumi has a soft side. Discover their new Azra bag collection and its pillowy pleats, satin finish, and crescent shape. Azra is the bag to carry for your 9-to-5 and your 5-to-9 plans that follow. Versatility, after all, is Tumi's signature. Shop the full Azra collection on Tumi.com or at a Tumi store near you.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with the first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
I'm now joined by longtime New York Times book critic Dwight Garner. Dwight is here to talk about Death of an Author, a book he recently reviewed that was largely written with the assistance of artificial intelligence, which is a weird thing. Dwight, thank you for being here.
Great to be here, Gilbert. Thanks.
So what the heck is this book about? How did it come about and why did you want to review it?
Oh, wow. It's very meta. First of all, Stephen Marché is a journalist, and he's written a couple novels as well. He's pretty well known. He's done a lot of things. And he was asked by a publishing company, Pushkin, which is, I believe, is edited by Jacob Weisberg and is presided over by Jacob Weisberg, the journalist and writer. And I think it was Jacob's idea to do a book entirely written by, or 95% written by AI. And what that means in this case is that Stephen Marché gave three different programs, ChatGPT, the major one among them, he pushed it in different directions, like someone rocking a pinball machine, or someone just pushing like a disc jockey in a way. And he kept asking questions, refining it until he got the kind of sentences and ideas he wanted, like write a plot that does this, give me an imagery that does this. And what he ended up with is, I write in my review that if you close your eyes and squint, you can almost see this as a real novel, but it's not terrible. And it tells a plot that kept me on the hook. In its simplest terms, it's about a famous Canadian writer. And she sends out a message one day inviting people to her own funeral. And she is going to speak at her own funeral. No one really understands this, but it turns out it's sort of a AI version of her that's going to speak. And in the process of her talk, it's one of those Agatha Christie-like moments where everyone in the room begins to think, who's the killer? She's been murdered. And everyone starts to think, who's the real killer here? And as the book goes on, AI starts to impersonate people. Everyone thinks they're losing their minds. It's very meta in that way. It's kind of about AI while it's being written by AI.
So for those listeners who somehow have not been following this particular conversation over the past 5 months over artificial intelligence, large language models, and ChatGPT. Basically, ChatGPT is sort of a copycat algorithm. It's a mimic. It's what people call a large language model. It's this algorithm that you can train on text. ChatGPT is a program that is owned by Microsoft. And they've been training it on large swaths of text across the internet in order to get to the point where it can interact with you. You can ask it a question and maybe it can respond, or you can give it a prompt and maybe it can give you something back. But you can also train ChatGPT-like algorithms on more discrete sources of information, like a single author or even a single book, which is what the New York Times did, our team at The Upshot did. They ran this experiment. What would it look like if artificial intelligence, and they call theirs Baby GPT, was trained to learn language only by reading all of Jane Austen or all of Shakespeare or only the book Moby Dick as opposed to the entire internet? And you can see in this feature, which you should look at to get a deeper understanding of how ChatGPT and other large language models work, you can see this feature that it starts spitting out gibberish after being trained just on 50 rounds of text. And then 5,000 rounds later, it's given out small words. And this is, we're talking fast. This is like 15 minutes. And then after 30,000 rounds, only 1 hour into training this algorithm on all of Jane Austen or just the book Moby Dick, it's spitting out actual sentences that can approximate English. It's not Melville. It's not Pride and Prejudice, but it's getting closer just after 1 hour to approximating what the English language might actually sound like. I was wondering if you hadn't been told that this book was mostly written by artificial intelligence, would you have been able to tell?
It wouldn't have occurred to me because I didn't know people were out there doing this already. But I would have thought this is a fairly mediocre novel. I mean, it has its moments. It works. I mean, it is a novel. And I did turn the pages and there are some arresting images. This is something we can get into more. But what, of course, this raises questions about what we're all doing these days and where our jobs are going and where literacy is headed, where writing is headed and what is an author and et cetera, et cetera. I felt coming away from this was good enough already that I think some of the more formulaic writers of genre fiction, of course, in genre fiction, they're always geniuses and they're hacks. I think the geniuses shouldn't be afraid of this, but the hacks might start to wonder if their careers are going to be threatened.
Absolutely. You jumped right to one of the questions I was going to ask, whether or not you could see this being applied in certain types of creative writing. As you point out, one of the most obvious is formulaic generic writing, genre writing. Genres are genres because they have tropes that are understood by fans and readers, and you can use them and manipulate them and combine them. And the best people working in genres are always going to be the best. But there's a lot of mysteries and romance novels and thrillers and other genres that are not the best.
And as Gilbert, often what sells the best is not the best. The geniuses in these fields sometimes sell a lot, but often it's the lesser lights that people just happen to sort of get a taste for, and they sell over and over again. Brand names that do the same thing over and over again. And I think they should be a little worried.
Yes, who should be worried? Writers across the board, are worried. Journalists are worried. The Writers Guild of America, TV writers are striking in part because of AI-related issues, although there are a ton of other issues that they're striking over. And authors of fiction and nonfiction are a little concerned.
Yeah. But as I say in my piece, and they should be concerned, and this is, we're entering a strange world. As we all know, I don't think any of us know how strange it's going to be. Reading this book, I started to feel that prickling in the back of my neck that I believe was Nabokov said is the feeling you get when you're reading a true genius. I was not reading a genius, but I was reading something that was close enough to sounding like a human being written by a computer that it was a little spooky for me. I make the point in my piece that I think the critic Clive James once said that originality is not just a quality of poetry. Originality is poetry. And I think that real artists and real fiction writers, the people who are just geniuses at observation and not just storytelling and making sense of our world, are not the kind of people who will be in danger from this kind of thing. It's the people who are writing to give an audience what they want and what they expect. And this will serve that. I want to hit the bar and get another pellet of this thing that I like. That may come to serve for many readers.
And as Stephen Marché points out here, it's not as if you're saying, hey, ChatGPT, write a mystery in which this happens and go do it. He used these three programs to get to a certain point. He gave ChatGPT a prompt or a plot or an outline, and then it spit out. Then he went to another program and used that to massage the language and the style and the length of certain sentences. And then he went to a third program that he used more for figurative language and similes and stuff like that, right? So it's actually, I'm not saying this makes it good or bad, but there's a fair amount of work, at least at this early stage, that had to go in to even producing this sort of okay thing.
I'm glad you brought that up, because one of the points that he makes, and I think it's a good point, is that he thinks that, what's the old software programming term? I think it was GIGO, G-I-G-O, garbage in, garbage out. His point is to use these programs well, you're going to need to know a lot. To use them really well, you're going to need to be sort of a literary-minded person. He compares it to hip-hop DJs. And to do that kind of thing, to mash things up, to make people really love what you're doing, to create a new feeling, you need to know the genre. You need to know music. You need to know all kinds of things. It's not just, you go by feel, yes, but his point is you can go by feel, which is what an artist does, to use these programs, A, but B, the more you know and the better you can direct it, the better stuff you'll get out of it. So his point is the best users of ChatGPT will be the best thinkers.
In your review, you wrote many wonderful lines. I just had to pull one out because this really stuck out to me. You said, the prose mostly has the crabwise gait of a Wikipedia entry. If this novel could exhale, its breath would surely smell, to borrow words from Ian McEwan in his novel Machine Like Me, like the back of a warm TV set. Very evocative. What struck you as off, if anything, in this book?
It just has a slightly awkward feel at times. You know how you're reading Wikipedia sometimes and, you know, it's prose, but it's a little weird. It's not really shapely. The paragraphs don't quite begin and end. They kind of just cut off, and it has that kind of vibe. And a lot of the metaphor and simile doesn't really work. I'm trying to think, there's one or two things that I pick out in my review. I'm not sure I can find them now, but a lot of the similes and metaphors are just weird and the kind of things that you think a computer would think up and not really a human being.
I wanted to ask you about that, actually. I don't mean to embarrass you, but you're really good at similes, so much that Harper's Magazine recently had a little feature where they collected some of your more memorable similes. So I have to ask you about the figurative language. Like, what did you make of it? Because that's where writers can often be the most creative.
Yeah. And I think that Marsh makes the case that as he pushes, like someone working a Moog synthesizer, he's pushing these programs to create figurative language. I think it's going to be someone like him, a presiding intelligence, picking the best imagery the computer spits out. A lot of it's going to be hallucinatory. There's one line in the book that's pretty typical of the language. He writes, or the bots write, the smell of coffee was like a fog burning off a field. I mean, that's weird. It's more of a visual thing. There's no smell to fog, really. Anyway, it's a weird, it almost works, which is true of the book itself.
I think what it's lacking, I think you say this, maybe you don't say this precisely, but essentially it lacks a soul, right? If any of us have seen any movies about androids and artificial intelligence or read any books about these topics over the past many years, that is the thing that is lacking at first. And then that is the thing that makes you feel sorry for the robot later in the movie. Roy Batty on the roof at the end of Blade Runner saying, all my memories are going to disappear like tears in rain. This writing lacks a soul. And I think that is the thing that's going to be the leap that might never be made. That's my hope. That's the thing that's going to separate it.
No, absolutely. What freaks me out a little bit is someone who I think soul can sometimes be manipulated. I always get my guard up when something's trying too hard to be soulful. But when something comes at me obliquely and it's witty and it catches me off guard, and to be fair to the Borgs and be fair to Stephen Marsh, there's some wit in here. There's this weird moment. He manages that this machine can sort of joke to a certain degree. People have taught it vaguely what irony is, and it's not uncomplicated, this language.
One fear, I think, is not that artificial intelligence will be able to precisely mimic the creativity, the creative leaps that goes into making great literature, but it's really that readers won't care. Mm. That if something is decent enough, then the fact that it was not written by a person, or primarily a person, won't really matter to enough people in order for it to turn them off from buying it or consuming it.
This is going to sound snobby and cruel, which perhaps we book critics are at times. There's a big readership out there who, you look at the bestseller list, and often great things appear there. I'm not knocking every bestselling writer by a long shot, but there are writers, and I'm not going to name any of them, who appear regularly in the bestseller list. It's pretty bad stuff. It's pretty sorry. It's pretty repetitive. It's pulling the same heartstrings. It's like going to Olive Garden. Not to knock Olive Garden. You know what you're going to get. You go to Olive Garden. There's a reason why critics don't review Olive Garden. There's a reason why the New York Times critic isn't going there, because the New York Times food critic's in pursuit of the best things people are doing, how they're pushing it, what they're doing to make it new, interesting, original. That's what the critic's job is, to find those things, to try to celebrate them, to bring us all forward. And these programs are going to be able to do that Olive Garden level writing, which is a lot of what's out there. And I think people may not mind having it written by ChatGPT.
Are you concerned about the implications for how this technology might affect the work that you do?
Possibly. I love to read critics. I've always loved critics. And the best ones are so funny and so shrewd. And there's so much intelligence and feeling and wit that goes into good criticism that, no, I don't feel like they'll ever be able to get the great ones. Will they catch me and devour me? That's possible.
I don't think so, Dwight. But, I'm going to lean over and pat you on the shoulder.
Oh,
yeah,
Gilbert.
There you go.
No, there's, as we all know, we all read. I'm taking the ball and running off the field, but there are fewer and fewer book critics in America. There used to be a lot of us. Now there are very few of us because newspapers are dying everywhere. They're dead everywhere. Often what you read that's called criticism is pretty low. I mean, it's not great stuff. And I think ChatGPT will be able to write quote unquote words that sound like criticism.
Dwight Garner here today, speaking words that sound like criticism. Dwight, as always, thank you for coming on this podcast, which you've been on many times before, and which, correct me if I'm wrong, did someone tell me you're the first host of this podcast?
Yeah, I actually dreamed this podcast up, along with Sam Tannen. I mean, I won't take full credit, but I remember walking into Sam's office one day and saying, we should think about something like this, and I didn't really have any plan or anything, and Sam just, oh, what a great idea, and ran with it, and suddenly we were just doing it one day, and it was fun. It's always been fun. It's fun. I'm really glad you were doing it again, you know, because I kind
me
of died
too.
There for a while.
I took the ball, and now I'm running with it.
It's fun.
Thank you, Dwight. Thanks for being on, as always.
Thanks, Gilbert.
Those are my conversations with Jude Beiersdorfer about the work of Neil Gaiman and Dwight Garner about the new AI-written novel Death of an Author. Next weekend is Memorial Day weekend, so the Book Review podcast will be taking off sometime so that I could read outdoors for once. We'll return to our regular schedule the week after that. I look forward to seeing you then. I'm Gilbert Cruz, editor of the New York Times Book Review. Thank you for listening.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.